I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
What role will technological innovation play on the road to universal well-being? While technological innovation has immense capacity to shape human society, the way new technologies are designed, conceived, and adopted determine their impact on our lives just as much as the science behind them. In this episode, we're speaking with Nicolas Halchaud, founder and director of the EPFL École Lab in Lausanne, Switzerland.
The EPFL École Lab is a collaboration between Lausanne's Mayer Technical University and Art and Design School, focusing on fostering innovation at the crossroads of technology, design, and architecture.
We ask Nicolas why he thinks this multidisciplinary approach to technological advancement is so important in our path forward as a society.
Take a listen.
Hello, my name is Nicolas Halchaud. I have a first background as a scientist, as an engineer, but then I worked mostly as a scientific journalist. So I had really the chance to travel a lot in the world to witness what was happening in the lab and to see how innovation moves. That was mostly in the 90s. And the thing is, I could really witness that our innovation right now is mostly tech-driven. Then came back to the EPFL, which is one of the two Swiss Federal Institutes of Technology. It's really a massive campus, 2,000 PhD students. And we had an incredible growth between 2000 and 2010. And still, I could witness that we have about 360 labs on campus. And mostly, they're producing really good science, impressive technologies. We had also a fantastic growth with startup company on the campus win the Innovation Square. And one thing that's after some years, I could really see is that we invest a lot of money and effort and knowledge in this technical performance. But what do we do with this? And that's really a question, because our life is not done only about performance. It's also about cultural context. It's about emotion. And so what's driving me? And nobody was really studying the impact and the creation also of new user experience. What do we do with this technology? What are the critical points of acceptance? And I think this is really a point that matters. I had also the chance to be not only a scientist, but also to work a lot in the field of art and making movies, working with different designers, photographers. So I always combine these two skills between art and science. Usually people try to separate the thing, which is a bit, for me, a bit stupid, but that's unfortunately the case in a lot of places. And see why we're not able to bring more meaning in our daily life through innovation. Why we don't speak more about adoption issues. It's why during the early 2000s, I started to bring also the design school and the design and art school of Lausanne in connection with the EPFL, with the engineering school, and see, can we start to work a bit more together to think about this technology, to think about the usage? And that was really the start of what I'm doing right now. I created the EPFL Lab, and which is the design research center of the EPFL. And here we have now engineers, we have designers, and we have also psychologists to say, now, okay, we create cool stuff with the technology. For instance, augmented reality, you can bring information around the physical object, but how do you tell stories? How you create a credible link between the physical object and the virtual stuff? And that was really part of the start. But then we also added psychologists to say, okay, we have some cool stuff. We have, you know, pages in beautiful magazines, but then does it really impact the people in real life? Sometimes we had nice article, was good for my ego, but in fact, the assessment we could do in real situation, in real life context, didn't work as expected. And we learned a lot about the impact of this technology, about the acceptance.
When you talk about kind of the human side of innovation or the human impact that innovation has on people, could you give, like, are you talking about robots or artificial intelligence, or are you talking about the Amazon Echo? Like, what's the range of technology, and is it just any use at all that you're talking about, or any facet, or do you have specific areas of focus on the human experience?
It's a very good question. Often the people, when they visit the lab, they say, but you're totally schizophrenic. You work on so many different topics. It couldn't be credible. In fact, I think what makes really the base of the lab is really the methodology, how we can bring, you know, design research so that we are able to produce real design. We produce stuff, we're hands-on, because design is about creativity and creativity is about doing stuff. But we're also able to understand things, so produce reliable knowledge that we can publish. That's really, I think, the core thing of the lab. Then we, for sure, we have some specific area. For instance, when you speak about AI, which is, you know, the buzzword, everybody is speaking about AI, it's true that it has a lot of influence. There's, for instance, a big question. When we aggregate content, for instance, in the media that we all read, the danger is that we create fake news because we make bad aggregation, or we also transmit fake news. And here, for instance, there's a very interesting case is that most of the effort has been done in improving the algorithm, detecting the fake news. Everything with technology. Okay, you improve the reliability of the news, which is really good per se. But how people, the reader, can understand that it's more reliable? How do you create trust? And that's more complex. It really has an impact not only about the consumer, if they will buy your media or not, but also what will they retweet or resend out. So it has impact on the global reliability. And we see that understanding what creates, what induces trust is not so obvious at all. It's something, in fact, very delicate. It's not because you have a higher reliability that you have an improved trust.
That's such a fascinating question, because you have, I think, sometimes people think that the problems we see today are technological or will be solved by technological solutions. But it seems to me the biggest problem we have is developing a sense of common direction and agreement about how to work together on these problems. Not so much the technology involved. In most cases, we seem to have most of the technology already to solve, for example, climate change or income disparity, but we don't really have the means to create the hive mind, or the flock mind, where we're all kind of moving in the same direction. Do you have thoughts about, or is some of your work showing up as new ways of doing that, or new ways of kind of aggregating people or aggregating action toward a greater good?
So it's a very interesting and quite complex question. Why? Because at the lab, so we involve psychologists to see, now we have solutions which are linked really to the human perception and with the cultural context. And we can assess with psychological tools, which are what will establish individual perception. But what we haven't been able to do until now is to introduce you behavioral change, which is another discipline because it's more about sociology. And this is another dimension that we haven't been able to introduce. It's quite complex also to convince, you know, the investors to study the impact of human. Usually they are ready to invest a lot on the technology. They put things on the market and then they say, oh, nobody wants to have it. And they lost the money. Yeah. And say, oh, if you can understand the user, perhaps you can have sustainable innovation. Something that will last on the market will be good for the people, will be good for your return on investment. So it's already quite difficult to have this, what we call longitudinal study. It's not, you know, the hype or say, oh, it's fantastic. It's magic. You know, magic is the worst thing in terms of innovation. Why? Because when you go and you see a magician, the first time you're impressed, second time you try to guess the trick, and third time, no interest anymore, you go to another magician. So here, what we want to have, it's people using your solution over the time. So you need to have this identification, but that's really still individual impact. So what is important is also that we get, you know, this community sense. And this is something that we need still to address. We have just one project where we really look at impact towards a community. And that's perhaps a good start.
The question I have has to do with adoption that we've already seen happening at broad scale. For example, the introduction of the iPhone in a matter of a decade became almost a universal tool and definitely changed behaviors, whereas other technologies that have come out have not created that level of adoption. And So sometimes it seems like the technology itself has an impact on people's behavior, and sometimes it feels like the new technology isn't so amazing. Have you discovered kind of the difference between those two, or is it all just marketing?
No, I'll show that several answers to this. First, I think that's the smartphone, just so that we don't quote a specific brand, is something that's perhaps specifically the iPhone. There was really a cultural environment. It was not just a technical proposition. It was also a kind of a cultural proposition. It was also kind of a tool where you can, you know, exist more as an individual in the society. So it's kind of a postmodernist tool in the development of the society. So it also was aligned with the expectation of the society at this moment. And it also brought some new possibility, which is also cultural, which is emotional, which creates new relation with the people. And it's just one thing that popped up one day. It's a long process that evolved. But, you know, usually we speak about this this type of innovation. It's one that we show a lot with the social network that was also. But if you just think about what has been brought on the market or on the society during the last 50 years, okay, we have the smartphone, we have the mobile phone, we have internet, and that's really great achievement. We have the genome, but go back 100 years ago. Take the 1880 period to 1930. And what did the people experience? The first fridge, electricity, the motorized flight, the transcontinental transmission, the first antibiotic. You have so many. Just think about the first fridge. My grandmother, and I used to know her, she experienced 10 times more innovation than I did. So yes, we have the iPhone, but okay, but you know, we didn't invent something like the fridge. And so I think I'm sometimes a bit cautious. I think we have much more innovation, much more information circulating around, but do we have really new fundamental innovation? Yeah, we have some, but perhaps not as much as we used to have 100 years ago.
For me, it's a lot about connection, right? And I think it's almost like a fake connection sometimes, what innovation brings us. And I've seen a study on, it was particularly the use of social media on teenagers, which apparently was really drastic. How there is anxiety and a lot more anxiety in teenagers now, right? And it seems like it was like almost like a huge guinea pig experiment, right? To leash out this kind of new tech and then just let's experiment with our teenagers. And shockingly, in this article, it was also mentioned that the people who knew about these effects, these psychological effects of like buttons and et cetera, did not allow their own kids to use it. Isn't that fascinating, you know?
On the one hand, you can look at, I think it's Socrates, in the Hellenic ancient history, who said, oh, no, this new generation, they're totally lost forever because they're getting too stupid, they're using new stuff. And so it's about 3,000 years that we say that everything is over. So I think we just must be careful sometimes with this kind of studies. I'm not sure, and I haven't read this study. But on the other hand, to go in your direction, we have the chance to make a very important project with elderly people. We have been working with the Royal College of Arts, with Pro Sonecto, the National Association with Elderly People. And what I can tell you today is that do you have success in innovation, digital innovation, and you want to have something quite large, work with the senior, with the old people. Don't work with the millennials. It's wrong. The driver of the innovation are the oldies. And I can tell you why. Because we made this test, and usually you say, oh, yeah, we do something for the millennials, and then we need to make, yeah, we have the old people, and so we need to take the list of the impairment that they can have. Let's put some bigger buttons and things like that. Okay, you improve the physical ergonomy. You make big buttons. They it's good. They go faster. They do less mistake. Nothing bad. But in fact, they don't really need this because you must not consider the old people as poly handicapped. If you have a handicap, it's something special. But most of the people, they can wear glasses like I'm doing right now. They can compensate the thing. And when you have this interface for elderly people, what does it say? I've been done for you, poor old person who is not, because you are not able to use normal stuff. And then they induce trust is something terrific. And they put this to trash. Whereas if you just speak to them normally, probably will go much better. And what we saw is, in fact, it's not an issue of capacity for most of them. For more than 90% of them, it's not an issue of capacity. What they want to have is really, it's a matter of trust. It's a matter of credibility. It's a matter of having something working in the real life. It's what you were saying, Stephanie, before. It's not something virtual for virtual, blah, blah, blah. They want to have something which is really credible and has an influence in their real life, which is really useful. And when you have something which is working well, you go back to the younger people and say, but it's really cool because it's has real impact and they really like it. So it's why we could really see after 4 years of study, and we are in words with this, and we have now it's re-implemented as a new service, that we can really see that innovation, digital innovation, it's much better to work with elderly people because they're a bit more critique. They want to have the real impact. They're just not here just to follow the hype. And this is quite interesting because often we have wrong beliefs about usage, about people, perception, and things. And here it's a very good example. And it's about, you know, impact for the social life of people. It's impact for the economy, for everything. But it's something that we just ignore because we don't study this kind of stuff.
So it's basically all about utility.
Utility? Well, I think it's more than that. You're talking about a broader adaptation than just using something, but having an actual emotional impact or value-based impact on the user.
Yeah, it's really dealing with an emotional perception. It's the impact in the real life. So it's the connection between the digital and the real life, but also it's the cultural context that you need to address. And this is because, for instance, the old people, they really want to have more trust. And trust now is something which is difficult to evaluate. So it's always based on subjective perception. And here we need to address also this dimension. And this is something when you understand this well, you can go back to larger impact. For instance, now we're introducing these new tools in new neighborhoods, big quarter. When you build new neighborhoods, how can you create or improve, I would say, the social network to create a really nice life in this new neighborhood? And this is also all the research that we have done with the elderly people is something that we can use now for intergenerational work in this new neighborhood and trying to improve this social life and cultural life in this area.
So what is the most innovative technology you think that is out there, truly innovative, not just incremental?
So, you know, I usually speak more about the use of the technology.
Okay, then which is the user that's the most...
one of the projects for us, which is perhaps the most, I would say exotic, but... the most special that we have done recently, and we just got a nomination at Fast Company last November. It's working with tools to support meditation because, you know, you have a lot of things and it's really about well-being, how you can help people to be a bit more centered, to feel better with themselves. And here meditation techniques can be obviously a help. For sure, there's a lot of digital device on the shelf, and some are really not working well, some are a bit better. But here we have the chance to work in a very specific context. It's to work within a new Taoist temple that was under construction. It's a very big one, which is in Basel, Switzerland, probably the biggest in Europe right now. And so we could confront all this new ideas of design, technology, and thing, and to confront it with a millenary culture and see how this can work, how we can face this ancient heritage that is here for more than 2,000 years and make sense with our new things. And in fact, the outcome is very impressive. It's quite spectacular. And now we have, you know, station where people can have biofeedback tools. you're facing, the immortal statues. So it's something which is very specific to this context, but we have a lot of learning that we can apply in other environments. We were working with light, with sound, in collective areas. So here we have the collective dimension. And here we try to learn also how we can perhaps reduce the perception of stress in collective areas where which are more and more densified architecturally, for instance. Can we play differently with the lights, with the environments, with the conception of space to create a different perception of the space? I think if we could help people to be a bit less stressed despite this densification of our cities, that could be a fantastic achievement. But it's still on. We have already some first results, and hopefully we'll move further with this project.
Very nice. So could we also raise awareness? For example, really interested in this collective dimension, right? Because in a way, there is no other way than a collective response to all these crises we are facing as a global society. And so through what you've just said, I'm actually serious. could this be a sort of a collective conscious warning system? For example, how much energy are we collectively, globally using at the moment?
Or even just feedback for the hive mind that we were speaking about earlier. It seems to be, creating an acknowledgement of this collective intelligence, right?
Yeah, bringing it out from this kind of, whether dream space, economy, fantasy, wishes to, this is our lives, this is reality, this is where we are.
But I think that's really one of the biggest issues that we have right now is that we have a lot of information, for instance, around environment, what we're doing. Just think about the house. Okay, you can have, the amount of energy that you consume, but what is really the relation that you have with your house, with your environment, with all this data? And this is something which is not addressed properly. Right now with the COVID situation, for instance, it's something that really strikes me, and it's for me just incredible. If you just look at the data that are provided, that's really collective. And we know that if we understand better this collective data, we perhaps can behave a bit better in terms of freedom, and sometimes by just reducing some of the activity to spare the life of others. But what do we show? It's really this interaction with the data are totally strange. When I look to the data, at least in Switzerland that we have, but also look at the web, it's like if the weather forecast was showing me the temperature that was measured yesterday in Alaska and Pacific and other things. It's just, the data that was coming from yesterday. And nothing that can really induce a proper behavior, a perception, where on which I can react, I can behave, I can understand. When you have the weather forecast, they tell you, oh, be careful if you go here you might have avalanche in the Alps, what we have, because we have some good snow right now here, or you have rain, or be careful, you might risk some accident with the others because it's icy. So you have forecasts and something that helps you in the real life that is useful. What we're doing with the COVID, we're just looking back in the mirror. For sure, when you create your weather forecast, you'll need also to take the data from yesterday to create your forecast. But you must go one step further. But for this, you need to understand what is meaningful in terms of data, what you can create, what is the impact on the behavior of people, what's also the emotional impact of the people. And this is something that is not studied at all for me. And I think this is what is striking for me. And that's a real issue for the society in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually been kind of an interesting distinction between countries with respect to COVID. And I remember very early on in Pakistan, they had early warnings when you going into a neighborhood that had a lot of cases. So they actually were providing, not necessarily forecast, but real-time data saying, you're in a high-risk neighborhood right now, maybe steer clear of it. Whereas here in the States, we don't do that at all. It's a very interesting shift of perspective from, today we lost 100 people versus be careful, there's danger ahead, which is, I think, a huge shift. And I hadn't really thought about that, how to create that for almost all of the technologies that we use,
But But then you have also ethical issues, because, you know, if you say, oh, here you're, it might be in areas which are less wealthy, and say, oh, here they have not get the vaccine, or the, so be careful, they're dangerous, you know. And then it starts to be also a real issue in terms of, you know, social, ethical responsibility, because, you know, you could also put people on the side. And I think here we must really take care of what we could create, something like you said, bring the people together to find solution for this big issue, and not, you know, put on one side the good and wealthy people, and the other side the bad, nasty people, usually which are already in a difficult situation. And here I think it's how you can bring the people together and share this knowledge in a positive way. And I think this is also a big issue.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Always the challenge between rights and information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and fake news and good news.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes fake news are good news too, you know?
Nicholas, do you feel hopeful about the future of the human race? I mean, do you feel that the technological advancements and the emotional advancements are going in a good direction?
In fact, I'm totally desperate, because I just read an article in Astrophysics showing that our galaxy will bump into Andromeda 1 in soon, so we'll all die. So I'm totally pessimistic, but that will be in 4 billion years. So I can see optimistic for the next 3 billion years at least. So I'm usually quite optimistic.
Okay, we have a few billion to worry with to figure that
out. What about the next 10 years?
But I think it's mixed feelings. I think we must try to change a bit our mind. I think there's a lot of opportunities. We haven't been so wealthy globally. We never had so many tools, possibility to act. So I think there's a really huge potential. But we need to understand each other between the different disciplines, how we can work together and not be trapped in our own little circle, disciplines and positive feedback loop that help us to be safe in our little ivory tower. And I think this is important. It's the same for the scientists, for the artists, for the management. And I think people start to understand that if you work together, you can have really mutual benefits. It's better for the social life, it's better for the culture, it's better for the economy. So working together really improve things for everybody. But this must, you know, go through. We must abolish some of very strong barrier. For instance, you know, when you're putting artists and engineers together, usually we think, oh, that's the creative guy, it's the artist, and then it's the solid guy producing knowledge. That's the engineer. In fact, the engineer has also strong creativity when he thinks about new experimentation, new solution. When it creates disruptive solution, he's creative. He has its own creativity. On the other side, I think artists must be also entitled to produce knowledge. And that's the big issue right now. Usually we hire artists in artist residency. They make some cool stuff and say, oh, but you don't have the time to and the money to have a good understanding of the problem with a good state of the art. And at the end, there's no time and effort to monitor the impact on the user. So we don't give the capacity to the artist to produce knowledge or people around the artist. So then you have this imbalance between the people and you have not a good understanding. I think to go further, we need to have this better mutual understanding and respect. And so people can start really to work together in a better way. And I think when we do this, we have an amazing capacity to create innovative and positive solution, including for the daily life of people, not just about technical or scientific output. I would just give you one example. When we create a project, what is really important is that we discuss the research question and what we'll do together at the beginning of the project. Usually the process, you have the engineers, they produce a technology, then the designer try to package it in a nice way to sell it to the investors and to the client. And then perhaps you will have a psychologist, a UX psychologist, that will judge the work of the designer. And then it's the big fight, you know, because one's judging the other. When you say at the beginning, you say, oh, we all have our literature review, we have our hypothesis, what do we see together as the core question and the potential not solution? And then we ask a question, then we make the prototype, and then and the psychologists are already at the beginning with us, say, oh, that could be really an interesting question. We can observe the result in a certain way. Then we see the results, and perhaps it will work as we thought, perhaps differently, and then we learn something. And there's not, you know, a judgment on each other. It's a different relation, and that works pretty well. But that takes a bit of time. You know, it's this transdisciplinary work is not so easy, and it's important to learn each other, to combine the difference, and to be able to build something together. And that takes some time.
Well, what would be, in your opinion, kind of the most important question you would ask at the moment in your work?
I think the most important question is probably this relation between the virtual and the physical world. I think right now we have a lot of things, data that are in the cloud, in the whole digital system, but the ultimate goal is also to act in the physical world. We're still physical people living in a physical environment. And how we can create perception of this data, how we can make use of this content, have impact in a real world, I think this is one of the critical questions.
I think this was a wonderful ending. Is there anything you would like to add?
Perhaps there's one thing that you can add and you can put it on that. I think there has been a big confusion, you know, over the last 20 years, because it has been, you know, quite fashionable to bring artists, designer and disruptive innovation, design thinking, and start to make kind of a big soup, which is really confusing. And here, I don't say that design thinker, design research, artist residency, something is right or wrong, but in fact, you must really be careful what do you use for what, in which situation, and what are the goals for each parties, because all of this methodology can be great, but we must not take it for a wrong situation or a wrong context. And there has been, you know, a lot of, you know, fancy relation, hype around us, but often it's not used in the proper way. And that leads to frustration on the economic side, on the cultural side, on the engineering side. And they have each their own role. We had the chance to work with a big European project with Centre Pompidou to work on artist residency. We just made a publication last year at SIGGRAPH, for instance, on this, to say, what can artist residency bring to innovation, for instance? And this is short, it's really about freedom, it's exploration. Design research produce really potential solution, knowledge, because we work together to produce something together. Mm-hmm. Design thinking will be more just for ideation, but you think that you know the people. No, you don't know after 3 days the people. That's wrong. There's an illusion. But it's good for team building. It's good for ideation in some point. So we must be very careful when we start to work on this relation, have something that makes sense and that is not just a nice thing to do because it's just in the air.
I'm always intrigued when, like, East meets West, you know, because I think a lot of times in the West, we, like, look to the East and like, oh, this is so cool and so innovative, but actually it's been there for such a long time. And it makes me laugh a bit, you know, but it's very, very cool, very interesting, because we do have very different mindsets. There are different ways of thinking, different concepts, and it can enrich us and us as a society and us as humanity.
True. I think, you know, it's something that I hadn't really thought of, this idea of integrating not just East-West or black-white or red-blue, but integrating the kinds of ways we think and the disciplines that we have developed over hundreds of years, at least probably thousands of, you know, okay, engineers think like this and artists think like this, and we really are in a stereotype around those things. And perhaps if we didn't divide our minds and our human experiences quite so much, we wouldn't be in the predicament that we're in.
Right, but we are also trained this way. I mean, go to any kind of university and it's almost I mean, there are exceptions, and that's why I'm so happy about what Nicholas is doing at EPFL and ECAL. It's kind of this overlap where, as a student, you maybe have the opportunity to actually meet other disciplines, and dive into this collaborative spirit and explore it at a very young age. When I used to be at university, you know, well, I went to a very different university, but I know university very well, and there is not so much overlap.
But that's what I mean. It's the universities that have trained us to these silos of thinking, and in actuality, and maybe the pendulum is now, I mean, it's gotten more and more specific. Each silo is more and more specific these days. But maybe the pendulum is turning back and we're seeing more integrative approaches, more combined ways of thinking and creating new kinds of solutions. I mean, one thing we didn't really get into with him was like specific problems like climate change and how this new thinking would have an impact on solutions for climate change. And other than to say, you know, maybe they'll help integrate humanity or create a more collective mindset that would allow for that kind of solution. But nothing really specific.
I wonder if you ever if that can ever be specific, you know, because that kind of, in my opinion, that kind of overlap what you're, let's give a specific example what I mean. Like when, for example, an engineer experienced that kind of interdisciplinary way of working, or maybe even sort of ignite his or her artistic side while in collaboration, while meeting artists and whoever is on that team. Maybe then later in life, maybe it's not in this moment only, but maybe in later in life when he or she has to make a decision about something maybe as big as, I don't want to really compare it, but to construct an atomic bomb, I think was one of those decisions where I think one single human would have made a huge impact to maybe not do it.
Or to think of it as a different process or a different usage, or
right. And so I think what Nicholas is supporting is we have the facet mind. It's like almost like a Leonardo da Vinci kind of mindset.
Yeah,
and it's not just art, and it's not just engineering and architecture and all that. It's the facet and the whole human, which really has to be developed and has to be ignited in every one of us to come to a common whole solution for the world.
Yeah, but I think it was interesting what he was saying is like, you don't want the engineer to become the artist or the artist to become the engineer. You just want to almost create hooks so they can work together effectively. You know, like we got to grow little hooks and still maintain our specialties, our expertise, but be able to effectively work and see the other's perspective. I think it was cool. I liked the way he's conceiving of it.
I wish we had looked a little bit more into how the economic system really drives that kind of development, or rather doesn't drive at the moment that kind of development. You know, I think that as in, especially on the podcast, kind of our topic. Mm-hmm. And it is what we call maybe a hidden driver.
Yeah, do you think the economy drives specialization?
Oh, absolutely.
How does it do that?
You become the specialist in the field, and you will not be rewarded if you like leap into another field. Most of the times you're not.
And I guess it's also a part
of... But also, sorry that I interrupt you, Mel, there, because this is like, we're talking about like the old mindset, and then that we are currently, you know, shifting even the economic mindset. You know, there's been a lot of shifts going on, and that would have been interesting to talk about.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.